scientific mainstream. It had been subjected to thousands of studies, suggesting an almost laughably long list of health benefits, including salutary effects on the following: major depression, drug addiction, binge eating, smoking cessation, stress among cancer patients, loneliness among senior citizens, ADHD, asthma, psoriasis, irritable bowel syndrome. Studies also indicated that meditation reduced levels of stress hormones, boosted the immune system, made office workers more focused, and improved test scores on the GRE. Apparently, mindfulness did everything short of making you able to talk to animals and bend spoons with your mind. This research boom got its start with a Jubu named Jon Kabat-Zinn, a Manhattan-raised, MIT-trained microbiologist who claimed to have had an elaborate epiphany, a vision, he called it, while on a retreat in 1979. The substance of the vision was that he could bring meditation to a much broader audience by stripping it of Buddhist metaphysics. Kabat-Zinn designed something called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, MBSR, an 8-week course that taught secularized meditation to tens of thousands of people around America and the world. Having a simple, replicable meditation protocol made it easy to test the effects on patients. Things got truly sci-fi when researchers started peering directly into the brains of meditators. A blockbuster MRI study from Harvard found that people who took the 8-week MBSR course had thicker gray matter in the areas of the brain associated with self-awareness and compassion, while the regions associated with stress actually shrank. This study appeared to confirm the whole respond, not react superpower. The regions where the gray matter shriveled were, evolutionarily speaking, the oldest parts of the human brain, which sit right atop the spinal column and are home to our most basic instincts. As one person has called it, these are the want it, don't want it, have sex with it, or kill it zones. Conversely, the areas that grew were the newer parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortices, which evolved to help us regulate our primal urges. Another study out of Yale looked at the part of the brain known as the default mode network, the DMN, which is active when we're lost in thought, ruminating about the past, projecting into the future, obsessing about ourselves. The researchers found meditators were not only deactivating this region while they were practicing, but also when they were not meditating. In other words, meditation created a new default mode. I could actually feel this happening with me. I noticed myself cultivating a sort of nostalgia for the present, developing the reflex to squelch pointless self-talk and simply notice whatever was going on around me. A blast of hot halitosis from a subway vent as I walk to work, the carpet of suburban lights seen from a landing airplane, rippling water reflecting sine waves of light onto the side of a boat while I was shooting a story in Virginia Beach. In moments where I was temporarily able to suspend my monkey mind and simply experience whatever was going on, I got just the smallest taste of the happiness I'd achieved while on retreat. Even though scientists were quick to point out that the research was still in its embryonic stage, these studies had helped demolish neuroscientific dogma that had prevailed for generations. The old conventional wisdom was that once we reached adulthood, our brain stopped changing. This orthodoxy was now replaced by a new paradigm called neuroplasticity. The brain, it turns out, is constantly changing in response to experience. It's possible to sculpt your brain through meditation just as you build and tone your body through exercise, to grow your gray matter the way doing curls grows your bicep. This idea contradicted widespread cultural assumptions about happiness that are reflected in the etymology of the word itself. The root hap means luck, as in hapless or haphazard. What the science was showing was that our levels of well-being, resilience, and impulse control were not simply God-given traits, our portion of which we had to accept as a fait accompli. The brain, the organ of experience through which our entire lives are led, can be trained. Happiness is a skill. Among the unlikely people for whom the science was creating some open-mindedness about meditation were two hard-driving and successful women who both loomed large in my psyche. My mother, the original skeptic in my life, the debunker of God and Santa Claus, was very impressed by the Harvard study showing gray matter thickening in meditators. After reading about it online, she asked me to give her a meditation guidebook for Christmas. A few weeks later, she sent me an excited email saying that she had read the book and had decided during a taxi ride to the airport to give it a try. She was able to follow her breath all the way to the terminal without breaking her concentration. She then started sitting for 30 minutes a day, something that had taken me a year to achieve. The rough breakdown of my emotional response to this information was 80% validated, 17% humbled, 3% resentful. A few months later, on a visit to New York, both my parents spoke enthusiastically about how meditation had stopped my mom's snoring. When I asked by what mechanism this possibly could have been achieved, no thesis was proffered. Despite the ebullience, my dad was still not meditating, and like with my wife, I knew better than to push. I was also sensing some new openness to meditation from another unexpected source, the woman who, for me, represented the gold standard in professional diligence, Diane Sawyer. She was one of the most fiercely intelligent and insatiably curious human beings I'd ever met. She read every newspaper and magazine known to man. She wrote and rewrote her own stories right up until airtime. She studied for interviews or major news events for weeks, memorizing obscure yet illuminating details. Diane was inspiring to me in many of the same ways that Peter Jennings had been. She had a deep sense of responsibility to the audience. She insisted on providing viewers with useful information and practical insights rather than just doing the same old lazy story that everybody else was doing. She had a dizzying knack for identifying the key question at the heart of every story. Unlike with Peter, though, there were no temper tantrums. I had built up a reservoir of affection for Diane ever since she visited the ABC News Bureau in Baghdad when I was stationed there before the war. Shortly after anchoring GMA live from the roof of the Information Ministry, she came to our office and spent several hours just hanging out. Here was a woman who had worked in the White House, become the first female correspondent for 60 Minutes, and had more journalism awards than I have teeth, casually eating bad Iraqi pizza with us. That's not to say I didn't find her a little bit intimidating. When we went over scripts together, she inevitably asked me an unanticipated and incisive question for which I had no answer. At first, my meditation habit was a source of gentle ribbing. Diane had long teased me for being pure. She joked about my healthful diet, frequent exercise, and abstinence from booze and caffeine. I had recently quit both, not because I had become a straight-edge yogi or whatever, but because as I got older, my body simply couldn't tolerate them. I would try to defend myself, pointing to my dessert habit and taste for cheeseburgers. I did not, however, have the nerve to tell her I used to do enough drugs that it apparently contributed to my having a panic attack not 10 yards away from her. I fought through the fear that pitching Diane a story on meditation would only provoke an eye roll. I sent her an email suggesting we do a piece about how the scientific research was inspiring people in unusual places to embrace mindfulness. To my delight, she bit. When the PR woman in the leopard print blouse started dropping phrases like letting go and turning into your emotions, I really knew meditation was breaking out of the Buddhist ghetto. After Diane gave me the green light to do some mindfulness stories, my first stop was Minneapolis and the headquarters of General Mills, the corporate behemoth behind such brands as Cheerios, Betty Crocker, and Hamburger Helper. Everyone here was so earnest and hail fellow well-met with crisp demeanors and twangy Midwest accents, which made it all the more remarkable that there were now meditation rooms complete with zafus and yoga mats in every building in the complex. The person responsible for this was a hard-charging, no-nonsense, sensible haircut corporate attorney named Janice Martirano. She'd discovered meditation a few years prior, found it to be a massive value add, both personally and professionally, and started spreading it virally through the executive ranks. She'd trained scores of colleagues, including the PR woman whose job it was to shepherd us briskly through this hive of corporate busyness all day long. A big part of Martorano's success in bringing mindfulness to this unlikely venue was that she talked about it not as a spiritual exercise, but instead as something that made you a better leader and more focused, and that enhanced your creativity and innovation. She didn't even like the term stress reduction. For a lot of us, she said, we think that having stress in our lives isn't a bad thing. It gives us an edge. I liked this, a meditation philosophy that left room for the price of security. Martorano had a whole slew of practical tips that extended well beyond the meditation cushion. One of her main pieces of advice was a direct challenge to me, an assault on the central pillar of my work life. "So you're telling me that I can't multitask?" I asked as we sat down for an interview. "It's not me telling you," she said. "It's neuroscience that would say that our capacity to multitask is virtually non-existent. Multitasking is a computer-derived term. We have one processor. We can't do it. I think that when I'm sitting at my desk, feverishly doing 17 things at once, that I'm being clever and efficient. But you're saying I'm actually wasting my time?" "Yes, because when you're moving from this project to this project, your mind flits back to the original project, and it can't pick it up where it left off. So it has to take a few steps back and then ramp up again. And that's where the productivity loss is." This problem was, of course, exacerbated in the age of what had been dubbed the info blitzkrieg, where it took superhuman strength to ignore the siren call of the latest tweet or the blinking red light on the BlackBerry. Scientists had even come up with a term for this condition, continuous partial attention. It was a syndrome with which I was intimately familiar even after all of my meditating. Martorano recommended something radical. Do only one thing at a time. When you're on the phone, be on the phone. When you're in a meeting, be there. Set aside an hour to check your email and then shut off your computer monitor and focus on the task at hand. Another tip? Take short mindfulness breaks throughout the day. She called them purposeful pauses. So, for example, instead of fidgeting or tapping your fingers while your computer boots up, try to watch your breath for a few minutes. When driving, turn off the radio and feel your hands on the wheel. Or when walking between meetings, leave your phone in your pocket and just notice the sensations of your legs moving. "If I'm a corporate samurai," I said, "I'd be a little worried about taking all these pauses that you recommend because I'd be thinking, well, my rivals aren't pausing. They're working all the time." "Yeah, but that assumes that those pauses aren't helping you. Those pauses are the ways to make you a more clear thinker and for you to be more focused on what's important." This was another attack on my work style. I had long assumed that ceaseless planning was the recipe for effectiveness, but Martorano's point was that too much mental churning was counterproductive. When you lurch from one thing to the next, constantly scheming or reacting to incoming fire, the mind gets exhausted. You get sloppy and make bad decisions. I could see how the counterintuitive act of stopping, even for a few seconds, could be a source of strength, not weakness. This was a practical complement to Joseph's "Is this useful?" mantra. It was the opposite of zoning out, it was zoning in. In fact, I looked into it and found there was science to suggest that pausing could be a key ingredient in creativity and innovation. Studies show that the best way to engineer an epiphany was to work hard, focus, research and think about a problem, and then let go. Do something else. That didn't necessarily mean meditate, but do something that relaxes and distracts you. Let your unconscious mind go to work, making connections from disparate parts of the brain. This, too, was massively counterintuitive for me. My impulse, when presented with a thorny problem, was to bulldoze my way through it, to swarm it with thought. But the best solutions often come when you allow yourself to get comfortable with ambiguity. This is why people have aha moments in the shower. It was why Kabat-Zinn had a vision while on retreat. It was why Don Draper from Mad Men, when asked how he comes up with his great slogans, said he spends all day thinking and then goes to the movies. Janice Martorano was on the bleeding edge of what had become an improbable corporate trend. Meditation classes had infiltrated not only General Mills, but also Aetna, Procter & Gamble, and Target, where, as part of my Diane-approved field trip, I sat in on a weekly session at the corporate headquarters called Meditating Merchants. Mindfulness was also being taught in business schools and written about without derision in the Wall Street Journal and the Harvard Business Review. An article on financialplanning.com featured meditation tips for advisors. High-powered executives were using mindfulness to make sure that every confrontation didn't escalate into a fight-or-flight event and that every email, phone call, and breaking news alert didn't derail their focus. This trend had become particularly hot in Silicon Valley, where meditation was now increasingly being viewed as a software upgrade for the brain. At Google, engineers were offered a class called Neural Self-Hacking. An article in Wired magazine referred to meditation as the tech world's new caffeine. It wasn't just corporations hopping on the bandwagon, but also schools, prisons, the U.S. Forest Service, and, of course, the Marines, who were actively eyeing meditation as a way to effect a sort of psychological regime change among their own troops. The final stop in my field trip was Camp Pendleton, where I met the reluctant meditator, Private First Class Lindemann. The Marines were initially interested in mindfulness because they thought it might help them deal with an epidemic of PTSD, but there was also hope that meditation could produce more effective warriors. The theory was that the practice would make troops less reactive and therefore less vulnerable to the classic insurgent tactic of provoking the types of disproportionate responses that alienate the civilian population. What a counterintuitive notion. Meditation as a way to deal with asymmetric warfare. As the woman who'd convinced the Marines to conduct this experiment, Georgetown professor Liz Stanley, told me, there is nothing incensey about that. There just isn't. While there was reluctance at first, many of the Marines ended up liking meditation. Even PFC Lindemann grudgingly came around. He told me he now found it easier to calm down after stressful situations. At first, I was kind of skeptical, he said, but then you kind of start noticing a little bit of change. As you go further into it, you start understanding it. After shooting all of these stories, I, too, experienced a sudden vision. It wasn't as dramatic as Jon Kabat-Zinn's, but it did come at an unusual moment. The producers of Weekend GMA had decided to wire up a rental car with cameras, pack the anchors inside, punch in some GPS coordinates, and call it America's Cheapest Road Trip. The conceit? Have the cassetted on-air types drive themselves hundreds of miles to a seaside campground, pitch their own tents, and cook their own food. Hilarity ensues. There was even a patina of news-you-can-use value to this rating stunt, because the economy was still in the tank, and the piece would contain a few useful nuggets of advice about how to do family vacations on a budget. Somewhere between New York City and our final destination in Maryland, we stopped at one of those roadside plazas that have gas, greasy food, and bathrooms with fossilized filth dating back to the Mesozoic era. While I was waiting for Ron and Bianna to finish up inside, I decided to do a little walking meditation. About three steps into it, a family passed by and stared at me. I clammed up and pretended to check my BlackBerry. That's when I had my vision. Nothing too elaborate. I simply flashed on a world where doing a zombie walk in public wouldn't be slightly mortifying, where meditation would be universally socially acceptable. I felt nearly certain that this world was actually not too far off. Mind you, I was not predicting a Tolle-esque shift in planetary consciousness, nor was I forecasting that society would be overrun by stream entrants and non-returners of the Joseph Goldstein variety. Instead, I pictured a world in which significant numbers of people were 10% happier and less reactive. I imagined what this could do for marriage, parenting, road rage, politics, even television news. Public health revolutions can happen quite rapidly. Most Americans didn't brush their teeth, for example, until after World War II, when soldiers were ordered to maintain dental hygiene. Exercise didn't become popular until the latter half of the 20th century after science had clearly showed its benefits. In the 1950s, if you had told people you were going running, they would have asked you who was chasing you. The difference with meditation was that if it actually took hold, the impact would go far beyond improving muscle tone or fighting tooth decay. Mindfulness, I had come to believe, could, in fact, change the world. Of course, I hadn't gotten into the whole meditation thing to have a global impact. My interests were parochial. I wanted relief from the ego. Now, though, I found myself in the funny position of believing deeply in a cause. I began attending conferences with names like Wisdom 2.0, Creating a Mindful Society, and Buddhist Geeks. I made new friends like the beer-drinking, back-slapping congressman from Ohio who wrote a book about mindfulness, and the former J.P. Morgan banker, a guy so successful even my brother was impressed, who started a new venture capital fund specifically designed to bring mindfulness to scale. I experienced the surge of excitement as I strategized with my new friends about how to expose meditation to a wider audience. We had conspiratorial meetings and meals. We exchanged emails. We hugged a lot. In my view, the biggest impediment to Kabat-Zinn's, and now my, vision becoming a reality was meditation's massive PR problem. It was still mildly embarrassing to admit to most people that I meditated. This was largely because the practice was popularized in this country by beat poets, robed gurus, and hippies, and that cultural hangover persisted. Stylistically, the presentation of the average meditation teacher struck me as a bizarre cousin of the stentorian monotone that TV reporters employ, an affectation to which I had sadly not been immune. Just as we in the news business too often relied on shop-worn language, shock and disbelief in fill-in-the-blank tonight, Buddhist teachers had their own set of hackneyed phrases. Stories were shared, emotions were held in love and tenderness. While the secular mindfulness people had dropped some of this lingo, they had replaced it with a jargon of their own, replete with homogenized, hallmarkized, irony-free terms like purposeful pauses, meditating merchants, and interiority. These people needed a Frank Luntz, that pollster who'd helped the Republicans rebrand the estate tax into the death tax and recast loosened pollution laws into the Clear Skies Act. I wasn't sure that I was the right Luntz for this job, but I figured it couldn't hurt to pitch in. Ever since Bangor, I'd been obsessed with finding stories I liked and figuring out how to make them interesting to other people. Mindfulness, I now realized, was the best and potentially most impactful story I'd ever covered. In many ways, it was my craziest act of gonzo journalism. If it could help a monumental skeptic like me, I could only imagine what it could do for others. And I thought that if I could find a way to make it more broadly appealing, that would be a real service. One-on-one preaching to my friends and family was still definitely a bad idea, but finding new ways to get the word out to a wider audience somehow seemed less obnoxious. To succeed, though, would require finding fresh ways to discuss the subject. It brought to mind a former colleague of mine from local news in Portland, Maine. He was a reporter named Bob Elliott who used to post lists on the wall of the newsroom of what he called lose-ems, cliched words or phrases that were showing up too often in our newscasts. If any of the rest of us used a lose-em, Bob would shoot us with a rubber band. I took my first stab at addressing meditation's PR problem when World News aired my story on the increasing embrace of mindfulness in counterintuitive locales. We showed a graphic of a brain illuminating the regions that, to use Diane's words, got plumped up as a result of meditation. We used the soundbite from Rivers Cuomo, the lead singer of Weezer, who credited the practice with curing his stage fright. I explained how simple meditation was, that there was no need for robes, chanting, incense, or joining a religious group. When I walked off the set after my live shot, members of Diane's team were abuzz. Was it really that simple? How many minutes a day did they need to do to change their brains? The next morning, I got an email from Diane herself, who expressed an interest in learning more about meditation. If I could hook someone like her, it felt like a pretty good start. As excited as I was about the notion of popularizing the practice, the concerns of some of my old-school Buddhist friends, including Mark Epstein, did give me pause. The traditionalists did not appreciate the irony of capitalists and Marines embracing a practice with a history of disdaining violence and accumulation of wealth. They worried that mindfulness would simply create better baby killers and robber barons. They pointed derisively to the proliferation of books such as Mindfulness for Dummies, The Mindful Investor, and The Joy of Mindful Sex. Critics had a term for this phenomenon, McMindfulness. There was something important being overlooked, they argued, in the mainstreaming of meditation, a central plank in the Buddhist platform, compassion. While I'd digested enough Dharma books and lectures to know that Buddhists were always going on about compassion, I had long figured I could ignore the issue the same way I did with karma or reincarnation. It was true that mindfulness had made me calmer and less reactive, and that I now felt the urge to spread the word as far as I possibly could, but still, my goal was not to be Mother Teresa. Despite my powerful experience of being snot-soaked and supine while doing compassion meditation on retreat, I had not subsequently pursued metta in my daily practice. My resistance was based in part on the fact that compassion meditation was a little annoying, but more significantly, it stemmed from a deep-seated suspicion that we each have a sort of kindness set point, the result of factory settings that could not be altered, and that mine may not be dialed particularly high. I was a good enough guy, yes, I loved children and animals, etc. If no one was looking, I might even get misty during a rom-com. But the Buddhist concept of boundless compassion seemed out of reach. Once again, science and a well-timed personal encounter would shatter my assumptions. Chapter 10. The Self-Interested Case for Not Being a Dick. The international avatar of compassion marched briskly into the room and declared that he had to relieve himself. "First duty," said His Holiness the Dalai Lama as he bustled off toward the bathroom. He seemed sprightly, but certainly not as decades of relentlessly positive publicity might have led one to believe, trailing pixie dust. Moreover, the members of his entourage, often a reflection of the person they serve, were uniformly stern and unsmiling. I came into this interview with a bad attitude. Most of my friends in the meditation world revered the Dalai Lama, but to me, he represented the part of Buddhism with which I was least comfortable. What I liked about the Dharma was its rigorous empiricism and its unyielding embrace of hard truths. Here, though, was a guy in robes, anointed at the age of 2 because some government monks claimed to have seen special signs, like a rainbow in the sky near his childhood home. Fast forward a few decades and he was buddies with the Beastie Boys and Richard Gere, invited to guest edit Vogue, featured in Apple ads, and the subject of adoring movies by the likes of Martin Scorsese, who reportedly said he could feel his heart beat more keenly in the Dalai Lama's presence. My contrarian impulses were heightened by the fact that I had just watched a bunch of scientists here at Emory University fawn all over the Dalai Lama. As the academics presented the results of their research on the effects of meditation, they leaned forward, literally on the edge of their seats, while obsequiously calling him "Your Holiness." Meanwhile, he sat there wearing an oddly inappropriate sun visor, presumably to protect his eyes from the overhead lights. Once His Holiness had emptied his bladder, he was back in character, the smiley guy we know from gauzy hagiographies. The Emory conference had just wrapped up, and we were going to do the interview backstage. I started by asking about his long-standing support for scientific research into meditation. "There's a risk," I said. "What if scientists discover something that contradicts your faith?" "No, no risk. If a scientist confirms non-existence of something we believe, then we have to accept that." "So if scientists come up with something that contradicts your beliefs, you will change your beliefs?" "Oh, yes, yes." Reassuring answer. I wondered to myself, though, whether this policy applied to the issue of rebirth. If scientists could prove that he wasn't the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama, it would erase all his religious and political power, leaving him just one more old man in a visor. "Next litmus test, is your mind always calm?" I asked. "No, no, no. Occasionally lose my temper." "You do?" "Oh, yes. If someone is never lose temper, then perhaps they may come from another space," he said, pointing toward the sky and laughing from his belly, his eyes twinkling beneath his thick glasses. "So if somebody says to you, 'I never lose my temper,' you don't believe them?" "No. And some people say this is some miracle power. I don't believe. Within minutes, he had already proven himself more reasonable than either Eckhart Tolle or Deepak Chopra. As I sat there, surrounded by cameras, my crew, the Emory PR people, and His Holiness's Tibetan retinue, it dawned on me that the Dalai Lama was yet another person I had prematurely misjudged. After all, even if he subscribed to a metaphysical program I didn't share, he had actually played a key role in jumpstarting the scientific research into meditation, providing both inspiration and funding. What's more, I realized, one should probably not overlook the whole thing where he responded to the Chinese invasion of Tibet, from which he barely escaped with his life, with repeated requests for forgiveness and nonviolence. As the interview progressed, my posture, both internally and externally, changed. It's not that I was feeling my heartbeat more keenly, a la Scorsese, but like the academics I'd scorned at the conference, I, too, was now leaning forward in my chair with the closest my face can come to a beatific expression. Meanwhile, I was relieved to find that the Dalai Lama seemed to be pretty engaged himself. I'd read that if he leaned back in his chair, that meant he'd lost interest, but he was still inclined toward me, eyes bright. Toward the end of our 20-minute interview, the Tibetans, like Tolle's people, were very strict about time, came an exchange that fundamentally changed my view on compassion. I brought up something he'd posted on Twitter. The fact that he had a Twitter feed was another reason to like the man, although I was pretty sure his staff managed the account. You have a quote that I love. You say, most of one's own troubles, worries, and sadness come from self-cherishing, self-centeredness. But don't we need to be somewhat self-centered in order to succeed in life? Self-cherishing, that's by nature, he said, by which I assumed he meant it's natural. Without that, we human beings become like robots, no feeling. But now, practice for development of concern for well-being of others, that actually is immense benefit to oneself. A light went off in my head. It seems like you're saying that there is a self-interested or selfish case for being compassionate. Yes, practice of compassion is ultimately benefit to you. So I usually describe, we are selfish, but be wise selfish rather than foolish selfish. This was an entirely new spin for me. Don't be nice for the sake of it, he was saying. Do it because it would redound to your own benefit, that it would make you feel good by eroding the edges of the ego. Yoked to self-interest, the compassion thing suddenly became something I could relate to, maybe even something I could do. After the interview, the Dalai Lama placed a white satin scarf around my neck and gave me a blessing. As our crew was packing up to leave, he called me back over one more time and said that if I was really interested in Buddhism, I should read his favorite book by an ancient sage named Shantideva. The PR people from Emory breathlessly told me this must mean he really liked me. Ultimately, I couldn't get through the book, but that notion about being nice for selfish reasons, that I kept. There was cutting-edge science to back up the Dalai Lama's advice about the self-interested case for not being a dick. Right there on the Emory campus, in fact, scientists had been studying regular people who were given a brief course in compassion meditation. The subjects were then placed in stressful situations in the lab, including having a TV camera pointed at them, a detail which, for me, was particularly rich. The scientists found that the meditators released significantly lower doses of a stress hormone called cortisol. In other words, practicing compassion appeared to be helping their bodies handle stress in a better way. This was consequential because frequent or persistent release of cortisol can lead to heart disease, diabetes, dementia, cancer, and depression. You didn't even have to meditate to derive benefits from compassion. Brain scans showed that acts of kindness registered more like eating chocolate than, say, fulfilling an obligation. The same pleasure centers lit up when we received a gift as when we donated to charity. Neuroscientists referred to it as the warm glow effect. Research also showed that everyone from the elderly to alcoholics to people living with AIDS saw their health improve if they did volunteer work. Overall, compassionate people tended to be healthier, happier, more popular, and more successful at work. Most compelling for people like me who were not naturally overflowing with loving kindness, there was evidence that compassion meditation can actually make you nicer. The leading scientist in this area was a Jubu named Richie Davidson, Harvard via Brooklyn, who now ran a large lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison called the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. His team had done studies showing that people who were taught compassion meditation displayed increased brain activity in regions associated with empathy and understanding. They also found that preschoolers became more willing to give their stickers away to strangers. My favorite study, done at Emory, asked subjects to wear tape recorders for days at a time, which captured their conversations. The meditators were more empathic, spent more time with other people, laughed more, and used the word I less. Compassion research was part of a larger shift in emphasis for modern psychology. For decades, scientists had focused mainly on cataloging human pathology and cruelty. But now, the positive emotions, such as happiness, kindness, and generosity, were getting their due. This research helped give rise to a new view of human nature itself, a move away from the prevailing paradigm that focused on the dark side of Darwin, in other words, the survival of the fittest. In the old view, man was thoroughly selfish, and morality but a thin veneer over a bottomless well of turpitude. The new view took into account a long overlooked branch of Darwinian thinking, namely the observation that tribes who cooperated and sacrificed for one another were more likely to be victorious over other tribes. Apparently, nature rewarded both the fittest and the kindest. I had my qualms. I worried that in competitive career fields like TV news, compassion was not adaptive. Also, I still wasn't a huge fan of doing meta, which felt forced and artificial to me. But I wanted the aforementioned benefits. So, with some trepidation, I added a parallel track to the ongoing science experiment I'd been conducting on myself. From a traditionalist standpoint, my approach to meditation, and that of most Western practitioners, was backward. In the Buddha's day, he first taught generosity and morality before he gave his followers meditation instructions. The logic was self-interested. It's hard to concentrate if your mind is humming with remorse over having been a shithead, or if you're constantly scrambling to keep various lies straight. In his typical OCD fashion, the Buddha even compiled a list of the 11 benefits to practicing metta, which promised that you would sleep better, your face would be radiant, people and animals would love you, celestial beings would protect you, and you'd be reborn in a happy realm. As usual, the list lost impact for me as it edged toward the supernatural. The intellectual underpinnings of the practice were compelling. We all have an innate feeling of being separate from the world, peering out at life from behind our own little self and vying against other isolated selves. But how can we truly be separate from the same world that created us? Dust to dust isn't just something they say at funerals, it's the truth. You can no more disconnect from the universe and its inhabitants than a wave can extricate itself from the ocean. I couldn't imagine myself conquering these bedrock feelings of separation, but the effort seemed worthwhile. A couple of times a week, I began adding metta into the mix of my daily meditation. Per Spring's instruction from the retreat, I'd spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of my sessions picturing and sending good vibes out to myself, a benefactor, either Matt, Mark, or my parents, a dear friend, my favorite cat, Steve, a neutral person, our overnight doorman, a difficult person, not a hard category to fill, and then all living beings, usually a National Geographic-style tour of the planet. On retreat, Spring had advised us not to include anyone we were attracted to, but at home I decided to add Bianca to the mix in her own special category. Suffice it to say, I did not enjoy the process of systematically trying to cultivate sap. I was never able to get anywhere close to the weepy catharsis of the retreat. But as the Buddhist books I read assured me, the point wasn't to make specific feelings happen on command, it was simply to try. The attempt itself was a way to build the compassion muscle, the same way that regular meditation built the mindfulness muscle. I'm not going to claim that what happened next was purely the result of doing metta. There may have been other factors like the inevitable effects of maturation or subtle peer pressure from my new friends in the mindfulness subculture. Whatever the cause, in the months after I started adding compassion into my meditation practice, things started to change. It's not that I was suddenly a saint or that I began to exhibit extra virgin extroversion, just that being nice, always important to me in the abstract at least, now became a conscious daily priority. I instituted a make eye contact and smile policy, which turned out to be genuinely enjoyable. It was like I was running for mayor. The fact that my days now included long strings of positive interactions made me feel good, not to mention popular. Acknowledging other people's basic humanity is a remarkably effective way of shooing away the swarm of self-referential thoughts that buzz like gnats around our heads. At work, I got better at abstaining from gripe and gossip sessions. Complaint is the background noise of news, as well as the secret handshake, like fax machines beeping at one another or dogs sniffing each other's rear ends. While I didn't entirely swear off this kind of chatter, some discussions were too delicious, I did my best to avoid it, knowing that I'd probably want to bathe in Purell afterward. I would see people losing their tempers, like fellow passengers at the airport going apeshit on TSA employees, and I would empathize. True, I might experience a brief burst of superiority and an urge to recommend meditation to them, but I could also, in the style of Bill Clinton, feel their pain, the toxins running through their veins. The Buddha captured it well when he said that anger, which can be so seductive at first, has a honeyed tip, but a poisoned root. It's not that I never got annoyed anymore. In fact, when you're mindful, you actually feel irritation more keenly. However, once you unburden yourself from the delusion that people are deliberately trying to screw you, it's easier to stop getting carried away. As the Buddhists like to point out, everyone wants the same thing, happiness, but we all go about it with varying levels of skill. If you spend a half hour on the cushion every day contending with your own ego, it's hard not to be more tolerant of others. I had to swallow hard and admit that perhaps the concept of karma did, in fact, have some validity. Not the stuff about how decisions we make now play out in future lifetimes. In my emerging understanding, there was nothing mechanistic or metaphysical about karma. Robbing a bank or cheating at Scrabble would not automatically earn you jail time or rebirth as a Gila monster. Rather, it was simply that actions have immediate consequences in your mind, which cannot be fooled. Behave poorly, and whether you're fully conscious of it or not, your mind contracts. The great blessing, and frankly the great inconvenience, of becoming more mindful and compassionate was that I was infinitely more sensitive to the mental ramifications of even the smallest transgressions, from killing a bug to dropping trash on the street. I recalled how my dad once described undergoing a shift in his professional life where the achievements of his mentees began to mean more to him than his own. I wasn't quite there yet, but I did feel an increasingly strong urge to provide for younger ABC News staffers the kind of advice and counsel that Peter Jennings and now Diane Sawyer had provided for me. I found that applying the price of security maxim by proxy, worrying about other people's professional challenges, was much more easeful than applying it on myself. It dawned on me that much of what had been driving me since the beginning of my spiritual adventure had been a not quite fully conscious desire to live up to my parents and my wife, all three of whom had, for years, been putting on a clinic in metta, even without a formal practice. Admittedly, there was a large amount of self-interest at play here. Not letting my mind get locked in negativity made space for something else to emerge. I experienced a phenomenon I had once heard Joseph describe, a virtuous cycle in which lower levels of anger and paranoia helped you make better decisions, which in turn meant more happiness, and so on. There were also benefits that might have been a little too selfish for the Dalai Lama's taste. For example, being nice was a great manipulation tool. Turns out it's pretty simple to win people over, especially in tense situations, if you're able to take their perspective and validate their feelings. And once they like you, they're much more likely to do you favors. For example, going into script meetings with a less adversarial stance meant that my coworkers might feel comfortable enough to volunteer ideas that would ultimately make me look smarter on television. It was weird to hear colleagues refer to me as one of the easy correspondents or make offhand comments about how relatively mellow I was. It was as if my bad old days as an intramural warrior had been erased, as if the anchor who'd been reprimanded for throwing his papers on the desk in Boston had been forgotten. I thought it an auspicious sign that not long after I started doing compassion meditation, the pro basketball player Ron Artest, infamous for jumping into the stands during a game and throwing punches at opposing fans, changed his name to Meta World Peace. Less auspicious, 7 months later, Mr. World Peace was suspended for elbowing an opponent in the head, giving him a concussion. My new compassion policy ran into a major challenge in the person of Paris Hilton. This was not the type of assignment that usually came my way, but for reasons I still don't fully understand, GMA asked me to fly to Los Angeles to interview Hilton about her new reality show and the recent arrest of her stalker. I barely knew anything about her other than the obvious, the family hotel fortune, the baby voice, the sex tape. So the night before the interview, I turned to my wife, who, aside from being a brilliant doctor, had a near encyclopedic memory for anything having to do with pop culture. I asked her to do some pro bono research for me, and she forwarded some articles she found online about the low ratings for Hilton's new reality show. Some entertainment reporters were openly opining that Hilton was in the twilight of her celebrity, having been eclipsed by her former friend, Kim Kardashian. So I figured, why not ask her about it? I had an inkling that it could cause some fireworks, but that struck me as a good thing. The next day, when I arrived at Hilton's mansion in a gated community built into a hillside, the crew was all set up, Hilton's assistants were buzzing around, and the star was up in her room, primping. The house seemed barely lived in, less a home than a product showroom. Nearly every inch of wall space was covered in glossy pictures and oil portraits of Paris. There were even throw pillows that bore her image. I did appreciate that she was an animal lover. The place was crawling with pets, 17 of them. Out back there was a doghouse that was a replica of the main house, complete with moldings, a chandelier, furniture, light, heat, and air conditioning. Soon enough, Hilton came sauntering in wearing dressy black shorts and a sheer black top with some elaborate stitching. There was something about her that made me ill at ease. Maybe it was just that I wasn't used to interviewing celebrities. Maybe it was that she looked right through me. Or maybe it was that we kept getting interrupted by various cats skulking into the camera frame. The interview started well enough. We talked about her TV show and her stalker, as previously agreed upon. I learned that despite her ditzy persona, she actually ran a genuinely impressive and profitable retail business with stores in 31 countries, selling everything from handbags to perfumes. She admitted that when she wasn't on camera, her voice dropped an octave. The requisite topics covered, I decided it was time to trot out the tough questions. "Do you worry sometimes," I asked, "that the people who followed in your footsteps, like Kim Kardashian, are overshadowing you?" As I posed the question, a look came over her face that said, "Where is this going?" By the time I'd finished talking, though, and it was time for her to answer, she confidently said, "No, not at all." "There's been some talk about the ratings on the show being low. Has that upset you?" "Still holding it together? No." Then came the doozy. "Do you ever worry about your moment having passed?" She paused, looked over at her publicist, and then issued a delicate snort, a sharp outbreath accompanied by a slight curling of the upper lip. Then she got up and simply walked away. The camera lingered on me, repositioning myself in my chair, my face colonized by an involuntary smirk. In television news, the storm-off is a coveted thing. This, however, was an unusual specimen. Hilton hadn't ripped off the mic while shrieking obscenities. She'd just kind of wandered over to the safety of her publicist. Still, I knew, for better or worse, I had captured a memorable moment. Hilton and her team knew it, too. What followed was a long, strange, and often tense negotiation. We shut off the cameras as the celebutante, her publicist, and her manager laid into us. At one point, Hilton turned to me and said, "You're treating me like I'm Tara Reid." Her manager tried to surreptitiously strong-arm the cameraman into handing over the tapes, but he refused. Paris herself outright demanded that we not use the material. She didn't seem to understand that I didn't work for her, that I was a reporter, not a staffer on her reality show. I stood my ground, although I was at times slightly overwhelmed by the sheer absurdity of the fact that I was having a fight with a household name. In fact, the decision about whether to use the material was not in my hands. It was up to my bosses. As I boarded a red eye back to New York, where I'd be live on the GMA set first thing in the morning, the producers asked me to write two versions of the story, which I referred to as the safe version and the nuclear option. When I landed and checked my BlackBerry, I learned we were indeed going nuclear. Right at the top of the show, in the open, they ran the video of Hilton walking away, and then they teased it going into every commercial break right up until it was time for my story to run. After it aired, the producers and anchors expressed enthusiasm. I left the studio feeling reasonably good. I went home to crash for a few hours, and when I woke up, the story had gone viral. Every entertainment outlet on Earth had picked it up. I clicked on The View and saw Joy Behar calling me rude. My heart sank. While ridiculous on a thousand levels, this incident did raise some serious questions about my compassion policy. Had I just committed an egregious violation? After all, I knew there was a possibility my pre-planned question would provoke Hilton to walk off. I was even kind of hoping that it would happen. But was I, in fact, rude to her? I tried to reassure myself with the notion that she was, after all, a public figure, and that the chatter about whether her time had passed was all over the blogs. All I did was ask her about an issue that was already in the media bloodstream. I didn't manage to entirely convince myself. There was a larger issue at play here. Was journalism, or any high-stakes competitive profession, really, incompatible with Meta? My job required me to ask provocative questions, to go in for the kill, as we say, and often that wasn't so nice. This question of incompatibility was about to come blazing to the fore. After all my nattering on about how Buddhism didn't make you lose your edge, how meditation was a superpower and blah blah, I would be hoisted on my own petard. Chapter 11. Hide the Zen. When the email arrived, I was marinating in sitar music in the ornate, honey-lit lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel in New Delhi. It was late 2010, and I was in India to shoot an investigative story about unscrupulous back-alley doctors. Back at the home office, an earthquake had hit. After months of fevered speculation about who would take over for David Weston, we finally received the official announcement from the head of the ABC television group. The name of my new boss was Ben Sherwood. He and I had a history. It was Ben who was in the control room as the executive producer of GMA when I had my first panic attack. Ben had been very supportive in that moment, immediately getting in my ear and making sure I was okay. As I stared at my BlackBerry, I began calculating what this announcement meant for me. Ben and I had always had a good relationship, I told myself, although with a twinge of embarrassment, I also quickly flashed back to moments when I'd mouthed off to him in an era when I was prone to do such things. There was that time when he'd asked me to do a live shot in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, holding up a handful of sludge from the soaked streets of New Orleans to give viewers a visceral sense of the scope of the disaster. I was exhausted and ornery after days of round-the-clock coverage, and I got a little lippy. I ended up holding the sludge. Ben was an unusual species in the broadcast news ecosystem, both in terms of pedigree and personality. A Harvard grad and Rhodes Scholar, he'd held a variety of senior jobs at both ABC and NBC. Between news gigs, he would head off on his own and write a book. He had three bestsellers under his belt, one nonfiction book and two novels. One of the novels had been made into a movie, Charlie St. Cloud, starring teen idol Zac Efron. He was extremely tall, crackling with energy, and capable of both earnestness and sarcastic candor. I didn't know it as I sat in the lobby in India absorbing the news, but Ben's arrival would precipitate a professional crisis. He began work a few weeks later. Things started off well enough between us. He was sending encouraging emails. For example, he liked a one-liner of mine during a live rap I did on weekday GMA. After a story about a young man who was forced to stand for an entire flight from Chicago to Florida because he was too tall to sit in his seat, I said, "Not a problem I've ever had." Then, when Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was nearly killed by a deranged, gun-toting college dropout at a Meet Your Representative event, Ben dispatched me to Tucson as part of the first team in. It was a round-the-clock work marathon. I'd covered mass shootings before, but the outpouring for Representative Giffords and the other victims was like none I'd ever seen. After a few days on the ground, Ben called me and we had a detailed, positive discussion about how the news division was covering the story. It quickly became clear that Ben was going to be the most hands-on boss most of us had ever had. He personally presided over the division-wide conference call every morning, putting on a master class in TV producing, variously engaging in pointed critiques and lavish praise of our work, including details as small as the graphics and the individual shots that producers chose in their stories. The call became appointment listening. His emails, evocative little tone poems, showed up in our inboxes at all hours. The man did not appear to sleep. He watched every minute of every show we did, and nothing escaped his attention. One day I did a story for World News about a new poll showing that mainline Protestant churches were losing membership. Distracted by other work, I hadn't put a lot of time or effort into the piece. I had basically phoned it in. As soon as the story aired, I got an email from Ben saying the writing seemed flat and unimaginative. He was right, and I had no defense. It was both terrifying and invigorating to have a boss who knew your job as well, if not better, than you did. He had served notice. No one would get away with lazy work. As I watched the entire news division scramble to reorient to this dynamic new presence, I made a calculation. I wasn't going to crowd him or go out of my way to impress him. I didn't put in any extra effort to produce special stories that might catch his eye, and I didn't angle for FaceTime. My motives were opaque, even to me. Maybe I thought it would be unseemly. I was now a guy who was hanging out with the Dalai Lama. I shouldn't be striving so nakedly, right? I figured he knew me, knew my history, I'd be fine. I'd lived through these seismic events before, including Peter's death and Charlie's retirement, and always emerged unscathed, if not enhanced. I had seemingly stowed my internal cattle prod in favor of a new, creeping passivity. Very quickly, my strategy, or lack thereof, began to backfire. When massive street protests flared up in Egypt against the dictator Hosni Mubarak, Ben flooded the zone with ABC News staffers. This was history in the making, the kind of thing I lived for. In the past, it was exactly the type of story for which I'd been first out the door. But this time, I did not get the call. Instead, I watched from the discomfort of my living room couch as Terry Moran and David Muir, among others, covered the story. The old me might have made an impulsive phone call or two, but the new meta-meditating me thought that approach, which involved making my case to the detriment of my peers, uncompassionate. As I pondered this dilemma, the situation at work only got worse. When a real, not figurative, earthquake and tsunami hit Japan, Ben sent David and Bill Weir over to cover it. At home, on the couch with Bianca, we watched the horror play out on screen. The images were overwhelming. My wife was in a puddle of tears, while the freshly minted brown belt in loving kindness was feeling badly both for the victims and himself. Not long after Ben's arrival, I reluctantly went up to snowy central Massachusetts for a meta-meditation retreat. Sharon Salzberg, an old-school Jew-boo and new friend of mine, had invited me up several months before. It was a nice gesture, and I had accepted the invitation, but given recent developments at the office, I just wasn't in the mood for it. Even so, I drove the 4 hours to endure 3 days of straining to generate good vibes. The setting was nice, at least. Sharon, Joseph, and another teacher named Jack Kornfield had founded the Insight Meditation Society, also known by regulars as IMS, or sometimes I'm a Mess. Back in 1976, they'd scraped together $150,000 for a down payment on a multi-wing, 100-room red brick mansion that had most recently served as a Catholic monastery. They had converted the chapel into a meditation hall, although they'd left up the stained glass images of Jesus. The rest of the building was decorated with potted plants, large geodes, and ancient Buddhist artifacts, which reminded me of the living rooms of my childhood friends with